You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. Today, I'm super excited to have two friends here on the show, one who has been on the show quite a lot. Hi, Alan. How are you doing?
Hello, Alexander. Happy to be on the regular podcast as opposed to the Friday podcast.
Yeah, very good. And Steve. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Hi, Alexander. Yeah, I'm well, thank you. Pleased to be here.
Very good. Maybe Alan, you can go second, and Steve, you can introduce yourself first because you haven't been on the show so often.
Yeah, no, sure. So, yeah, my name's Steve Mallett. I'm a statistician. I'm currently working at Veramed. I've been in the industry, lost count of the years, well over 20 years, initially as a programmer. I've been a statistician for, I think, nearly 20 years now. So, mostly working on drug development. Yeah, I've read the book quite recently. I've read quite a few of this type of book, an area that interests me. So yeah, looking forward to an interesting discussion.
Okay. And Alan, maybe you can also quickly introduce yourself to those who don't know you already. Alan has been on quite a lot of Friday episodes in the past, and of course, also in a couple of interviews with me.
Thank you, Alexander. Yeah, Alan Bedding. I've worked in the pharma industry for a long time, over 30 years, and left July last year to run my own coaching and consulting business. I read the book, So Productivity. I ordered it as soon as it came out. I'm a big fan of Cal Newport's work. Ordered it and, yeah, love the book.
Yeah, Cal Newport has written a couple of really good books, and Slow Productivity is a New York Times bestseller from him. And it's not that easy to get on that bestseller list. Although, as an author myself, I now understand that bestseller is not so much about how much you sell, but how fast you sell, actually. So it's how much you sell in a given period of time. Nevertheless, I think the book is quite interesting, and it comes with a couple of key points. Do fewer things, work at natural pace, and obsess over quality. And when you were reading the book, what are key takeaways for you from the book?
So the first big takeaway is to go from what Cal calls pseudo-productivity, which is that visible effort of doing work. So mega answering your emails, being on chats, appearing in the office all the time, and appearing to do lots of work, to moving to what's more slower but more productive. And many of the stories, or all of the stories, talk about how people have gone from producing something fantastic, but they haven't done it by rushing to do it. They've done it over a longer period of time. Some great examples of that where things have come at a natural pace, an important one, but they've also just been focused on that one thing, and they're obviously going to obsess over quality, because producing both of the first two without the last one is not going to produce fantastic results.
Yeah, Cullen uses storytelling quite a lot. He does that in his other books as well, and here it's again. So he has lots of different use cases about what low productivity means, and that it really is about producing something, and something that is worthwhile and that is really a big accomplishment, rather than doing lots of busy tasks without really creating something that is turning the needle. Steve, what's your most important key takeaway from the book?
Yeah, so I'm also a big Cal Newport fan. I've been listening to his podcast for a while. I find him a very kind of clear thinker, good communicator. So yeah, the book hangs together as a kind of thesis, very well structured consistently. So I enjoyed that. I did find that, what I was trying to do is apply the principles obviously to the work we do. And so certainly my role support clinical development projects. My initial thought, it's not easy to do these things. So do fewer things. My calendar's just full of meetings. And how can I, if I don't turn up to a meeting, that's not going to look good. So I think it's going to take creativity, I think, to apply. I did find on the downside, I agree with a lot of case studies. I didn't find them particularly relatable. So there's a lot of the case studies from active industries, talking about people like Jane Austen and Isaac Newton, which is like, yeah, I've been trying to apply the principles more in a more down-to-earth way to a jobbing statistician like myself. One thing I have noticed is that even when you have a meeting and there's a preamble before the meeting starts, you say, how are you doing? I'm busy. People always say, as like a badge of honor, I'm busy, as if, don't worry, I'm busy. It's something I've noticed since I've read the book. So I think for me, it's more a case of finding some practical tips rather than completely reshaping how I work, because I don't feel I have that much choice to some degree in how busy I am. Some of the tips around efficiency in terms of how we communicate, how we avoid unnecessary meetings, how we can, the admin that we have to do, if you do the admin in box, that reduces the kind of cognitive load. Things like that I found more useful than grand gestures that are probably not quite so easy to implement. But maybe that's something we can talk about, is how we apply these big ideas to a jobbing statistician working on a clinical development project.
Yeah, Ellen, how do you apply do fewer things as a general rule?
And I guess I'm quite lucky. I work for myself, so I don't have a boss sitting on my shoulder saying, you've got to do this and you've got to attend these meetings, you've got to attend these meetings. I have that ability. And there was a story that resonated with me being a coach myself. There was a story about a coach in there who reduced her offerings from many to one or two offerings. That is an amazing thing to do. It's risky because the more things you offer, the more people want to pick them up. But if you're just offering one or two and coming back, this comes to the limit, the number of missions you've got. So it's very easy for an entrepreneur, somebody who runs their own company, to have lots of different hands in different pies and then get lost. So the do a few things, you've got to add on the other bit, which is do a few things at once. And it doesn't mean achieving less. It means concentrating on a few different things. So limiting the number of missions, let's say I limit mine to consulting and coaching, but then within those, limit the things that I'm doing within those. So I concentrate on a few consultancy clients with my statistics hat on, but then in my coaching hat, I do one-to-one coaching. The number of clients I do one-to-one coaching with. There are some small activities that go around there, but they are the two big projects that I work on. So that's one of the ways I do that. Now, if I was to think of the jobbing statistician, so when I was working in a company, how would I do it within a company? I think you can apply the same rule. If you've got your one mission, which is you're a statistician, then that's your mission. But what do you then do with the limiting the projects? If you want to produce the right quality, then you really do want to reduce those, because you both know as well as I do that the more things you do, the more you start to panic and rush and produce lower quality work. Even if you try to produce higher quality work, you sometimes actually, by trying too hard, produce lower quality work.
Yeah. I think as a typical statistician, yeah, let's say you work on a number of studies, on a number of projects, don't try to work on all things at the same time. I think that is one of the key things. Yeah. Take one piece of work, really work through it, push it to that it gets to the next level, and then you turn to the next one. Yeah. So, for example, you have two SAPs to write and three manuscripts to review and five posters to put into. Do one thing at a time, one after the other. Yeah. And not work on all the things at the same time. I think in terms of the meetings, we get invited to lots of meetings all the time. I'm not sure we actually need to be on all meetings. Yeah. And of course, just not showing up is probably not a good solution. Yeah. But if you say, can we structure the meeting in such a way that I can just give my input in the first 5 minutes? Yeah. And that is the agenda item I really need to be there. And then I drop off. Or is there something that, is it a meeting where I just need the information from at the end? So is it that I just get the minutes? And with AI, it's super easy now to just produce minutes while you have the meeting. You don't need a minute taker anymore. The AI can do that for you. These kind of things can help you do lesser things in terms of really doing lesser meetings.
Yeah, I think that's something I've learned to do through experience. I think earlier in my career where you sit on like study team meetings and you might sit through, and you might go through all the functional groups and you wait for your turn and they give you stats updates. And so you may be even in 1 hour meeting and you have a 5 minute update and maybe you haven't got an update. So I think, yeah, it's having that courage to maybe decline meetings or just say, I've just got 3 bullet points. Can I just email them to the chair and just really pushing back on that? Because a lot of the way meetings are run are quite inefficient and a lot of people sitting around waiting. Yeah, I think we need to raise standards, I think, generally in terms of how we're expecting people to use their time. And I think it takes a little bit of courage to say no or to push back. And I think that comes with experience and feeling a sense of my time is valuable and, you know, and thinking where can I add the biggest impact and maybe limiting, as Alan said, limiting the things we do. So even within a kind of regulated framework where there's a lot of, we might have oversight to provide and functional support for different areas, there's a lot of wiggle room and a lot of scope, I think, for making things more efficient and reducing unnecessary use of our time.
And one of the things you need to remember is the reason for those meetings in the first place is because you took on an extra project. Maybe you took on a project too much. The bravery is pushing back on that project. If you're already at capacity with projects, the bravery to me comes with saying no to a project. Because when I'm saying no to a project, I'm then saying no to all of those additional meetings that come with that project.
Yeah. If you are at capacity, I think saying no is really important because you already said yes. You need to defend what you said yes to with 1,000 no's. Yeah, I think Steve Jobs said that. But also say no to multitasking. Yeah, especially when it comes to meetings. Being in a meeting at the same time doing something else, that is definitely not good practice because then it's really difficult to do anything of quality, either being in the meeting or doing something else. Your brain is just not wired to do two things at once.
I think that there's an interesting concept in the book of what's called an overhead tax. So it compares to, imagine you're given a choice of two tasks. That one is to write a really complicated report that's going to take a lot of thought and effort. And the other is maybe organize a 1 day conference. And it says people might go to the conference because it sounds easier. But actually, that type of task, you're taking on an awful lot of ad hoc emails and chats and back and forth and admin. And it's going to, because of the nature of that work, and he calls it a overhead tax. And when you're deciding how to spend your time, we're not very good at accounting for that sort of time. We can't avoid this overhead tax, but I think it needs to be factored in when we're choosing tasks to accept. So yeah, in that scenario, choose the complicated report where you have autonomy over your time than taking on something that your inbox is going to be overloaded.
Absolutely. Yeah, Steve, I concur with that one about the overhead tax, because even in my job as a coach, so if I look at my coaching side of things, for example, I may have a one-to-one coaching session, but I'll have a little bit of preparation for myself, but I'll also have that reflective time afterwards to reflect on that coaching session. So not just the coaching session, it's the other things that go with it that actually bring that overhead task. And yeah, any consulting task brings it, their emails, meetings, chats, if you're in with that consultant. And there's lots of other things that Cal talks about in his other books, which help with some of those aspects as well.
Yeah. I think the book very much goes in the same way as digital minimalism and deep work that he has written about. So do fewer things is one aspect. The next, he talks about this work at natural pace. What does that mean to you, Steve?
So I think within that chapter, actually, there's a section on the ideas of what's called seasonality. So you can, and I think that's relatable in our work, is that there are going to be some times where you're intensely busy and other times where you can take your foot off the gas. I'm thinking of working on if you're working on a FDA submission, it's all hands to the pump, long hours. You know, you can be very unpopular if you start working short hours. To be fair, I think projects I've worked on and the companies I've worked for, that there's quite a good culture in terms of accepting that, okay, you're going to be insanely busy for a few weeks and then allowing you a bit of breathing space other times. So I think the trick is when you're then not busy and you have some spare time to use that effectively. Maybe that's the time to work on your, people often call them non-project initiatives. There's always work to do, but if your company's giving you back a little bit of breathing space, then that's probably the time to be focusing on your kind of bigger projects. Maybe it's working on within PSI, a special interest group or something like that. So I think it's accepting that there's going to be, I don't think we can all work like Isaac Newton or these people at this one great piece of work every 10 years or something. But I think the idea of seasonality was an idea that seemed quite relatable to me.
Yeah. And I one of the things, the one that really stood out for me, and I talked about something very similar on one of the Friday podcasts, was this idea of making a five-year plan. And Cal in his podcast talks about lifestyle-centric career planning. And to me, the five-year plan fits into that. So almost like, okay, where do I want to be in 5 years? And working back from that. And that to me means to work at a natural pace. So bringing in the seasonality that Steve mentioned, it might be I can work hard on certain things for a short amount of time, but then I need to take a break. And the more I do that, the more I'll get to my lifestyle, what I want to see in 5 years. If you think about an athlete, athletes do this very well. Most athletes, when they're doing their training, do not train at 100%. They don't even train 80%. Most of them will train at around 20 to 30% of where they need to be. They don't go every session, I'm going to go for the max, I'm going to go for the max, I'm going to go for the max. They are aiming at one or two particular, I'm going to talk about a runner here, one or two particular races where that's where their target is. How do I get to that particular target? I don't try all my time, otherwise I'm going to burn out. And the subtitle, obviously, of the book is all about burnout or preventing burnout. If you're running and running always at full capacity without taking a break, without that seasonality, you are eventually going to burn out.
Yeah, I think that is a very important lesson. Yeah, that we need to take into account into our calendar. I think what I'm seeing is that people don't have these valleys anymore. Yeah, it's project completed. There's always the next one is already on fire. Yeah, and you go from rush to rush, and that's just not good. That's just not sustainable. Yeah, work is a marathon, not a thousand sprints after each other.
There's something that's come to me, Alexander, just as we've been talking, and as I've been thinking about this. In the pharmaceutical industry, we're driven by deadlines. What you've said there is we've got one deadline. The minute we finish that, we've got another deadline, we've got another deadline, we've got another deadline. I remember when I was doing my PhD, still working in the industry, within my first year, I hadn't really achieved much. And I was panicking. I was like, oh yeah, what's going on here? And my supervisor said, you have to think about the long game in a PhD. It's not about achieving a deadline now. It's about achieving the PhD after the end of your time when you do a part-time PhD 5 years. The end of those 5 years, it's about producing something of quality at the end of those 5 years. And that was a wake-up call to me that maybe it's not all about I need to hit this deadline. There's more to it than hitting that deadline. Yes, that deadline is important, but it's all about me as a person and then progressing me as a person, as opposed to I just need to hit that deadline. So coming back to Steve's point about seasonality, that to me is a really crucial aspect of this.
Yeah, let's go to the last bit, because you already mentioned that, and obsessing over quality. What does that mean to you, and how is that different from perfectionism?
Yeah, I think this isn't the most important section of the book, really, because without this section, it's just work-life balance is important, but it's been dealt with many times before. This follows naturally if you've created this situation where you have less on your plate. I think obsessing over quality, I think there's a phrase that says it both demands and enables kind of slowness. So one of the examples in the book, a musician who kind of escaped the music industry rat race, you know, that what she went on to achieve, the high quality, required that breathing space, that lack of busyness. And also obsessing over quality enables slowness, because you're recognizing your time is more valuable. Again, I think this comes naturally over time as you get progressing your career. You see, my time is invaluable. I'm going to do fewer things. And I think that gives you the confidence to focus on some things more than others. And it might, again, coming back to, it might be working on a PSI SIG and you want to make an impact on the industry, and you're choosing maybe to work with other colleagues in the industry on a piece of work, and it's got to be right. This is going to make a big impact. So quality, critical. Yeah, I think this ability to see the big picture that comes with experience, I think it gives you the confidence to know what to focus on.
And you mentioned, Alexander, what's the difference between this and perfectionism? Perfectionism to me is something you can never achieve. What is perfectionism? It's being without any sort of error whatsoever. That's just unrealistic. We're human beings. We can't aim for perfection. So we can aim for quality, and we can aim for progress rather than let's go for what is perfect. And the trouble is then, if we aim for quality, so aim for perfectionism, we just keep going and keep going and keep going. That's not going to achieve anything, because if we take our time, infinite amount of time to get the best quality thing out there, then it's not the best quality because we haven't achieved it in conjunction with the deadlines that we have for it. So there has to be time limit on producing that quality. And Steve's absolutely right. This ties everything up together, because it's fine doing fewer things, it's fine working at a natural pace, but if you're not producing quality in conjunction with those, then those two are going to fall over. It's almost like the seven habits. If you can do the seven habits, but if you're not being proactive and not tying it all together with the sharp and the saw, they're all going to fall over. So there's always one habit in all of these which ties everything together, and this is the one that does that.
And here we speak about quality. Now, when the audience hears quality, I think lots of people think about SOPs, working according to SOPs and things like this. What do you think Carl Newport thinks about quality when it comes to our work?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think it's quality probably means different things to different people. And so I think it's understanding the context. Even within our industry, I work for COO, so the fact that quality is driven by what the client wants and delivering something that's fit for purpose for them. If a client wants a report or a plan, analysis plan or something like that, it's understanding, obsessing over the detail may not be what the client wants. They might want something that's conceptual. And so it brings in listening skills and just understanding what the client wants, or the stakeholder may be a regulator. So it's understanding, again, it's to me, quality means focusing on the right things and putting your efforts into the right things. There might be a particular unmet question in a clinical development plan, and you need to fill those evidence gaps. And that's where the understanding where the regulator is going to maybe probably focus on these areas of weakness and putting your energies into that. So I think it's how we define quality really depends on understanding the overall context. I know I haven't answered your question. I don't really know about...
I think that is pretty spot on, yeah. Quality is if it meets or exceeds the expectations for the receiving end. Yeah. When you write a manuscript, it's for the audience who reads it. Yeah. If you do a submission, it's for the FDA, the EMA, or whoever will expect. Yeah. If it's for the client, it's what is the client really expecting here? Yeah. And yeah, at the same time, of course, you need to adhere to SOPs because that is what your auditors will want as stakeholders. But just thinking about the auditors is not really quality. Alan, you're nodding.
I am nodding. And I don't know if Cal's talked about this in his podcast, but if, for example, if you haven't done the groundwork of getting your processes right, so let's take an example where you're outside of the pharmacy. I think SOPs are necessary because SOPs provide an operational framework for you then to do your best quality. Because if they're not in place, for example, and the standard processes and the regulatory guidelines and all of those, they're not in place, you may have one sponsor doing something over here that's completely different to the sponsor over here. So they're not, so let's take the regulator example. They're not looking at, this might be great quality for you, this might be great quality for you, but it's not great quality for the patients, which is where the FDA might, for example, be interested. So if we take it outside our general lives, if we don't have standard things we do, so if we just live our life by going, yeah, I'm just going to do this, I'm going to sleep whenever I want to, I'm going to watch, I'm going to look at my email, I'm going to look at chats, and I'm going to look at social media without having any sort of structure, and that's what I think the SOPs do, they bring some sort of structure into our lives, then we're not going to produce quality because we're not structured. I think SOPs are necessary to bring structure to what to the work we do, which enables us to do quality work.
Yeah, very good. So if you think about all these kind of different things, how has that impacted your daily life? What do you do differently after reading this book?
For me, I think it's applying some things I already knew. Maybe as Alan said, there is overlap with some of the previous Cal Newport books. So practical things like time blocking and calendars, just trying to take control of my time and my calendar. Trying to see a bigger picture, so try not just to getting swamped by small tasks. I think there's a tip in the book about, you know, okay, we can't always just control our time completely, but for every meeting that you have to go to, you block off an hour, let's make kind of me time to work on the bigger projects. And so just trying to at least explore the possibility of doing fewer things and maybe fighting the kind of the guilt that comes with being less busy. As I say, with your colleagues, when they're all overloaded and you're trying to free up some time, that can be psychologically difficult, I think. It takes a little bit of courage, but at the same time, trying to see the bigger picture and having bigger kind of initiatives that we're working on that we know are going to make a big impact. Yeah, I think there are small practical things that we can do in terms of being more managing our time and the admin that we need to do and that's inevitable, trying to be efficient. I like, there's one idea in the book that I quite like is maybe rather than having endless backwards and forwards, what he calls it, asynchronous communication, create a shared document and say everyone puts their thoughts in and then you maybe have a short meeting to discuss the ideas if there are any conflicts. There are quite a few, as well as the grand ideas, I think there's quite a few kind of practical tips in the book that I've certainly been thinking about implementing.
Yeah, where I've used it, Alexandra, is thinking particularly about the limiting the number of missions and then limiting the projects within the missions. And so yeah, every request I get, I like I said before, I'm fortunate, I work for myself, I have control over my calendar. Most of the time I have control over my calendar. So I can, for example, if it's a sunny day like it is today and I want to go out for a walk, don't have any meetings, great, I'll go out for a walk, but I can then think about a problem while I'm going out for a walk. That's something that's there in the book, but I've limited that down. So yesterday, for example, I got a request for a new project. I said, no, I'm at capacity because I realized actually that project's going to bring in so much more overhead that it's going to take away from these other projects and therefore limit the quality. So I think it all comes, there's a lot comes back to that saying no, particularly when it could be great. You look at it and you go, well, that's a fantastic new project, but maybe I've got to step away from that. So every new project I think about now under my coaching and my consulting, what sort of overhead is it going to bring? Is it going to bring too much overhead? And if it is, then decline it. And I've also recently given up a diploma in something because that was producing too much overhead, which was taken away from my other projects. So I'm creating myself space. But again, like I say, I have more autonomy over my work from that perspective.
I think for me, one of the most important things is not seeing being busy as a proxy for being productive, but actually looking into what is really the outcomes that I want to achieve and create quality for these outcomes and not being in my inbox or my LinkedIn or whatsoever, or you can probably count lots of social media there all the time, but really focusing on fewer things at a given time point and then really make meaningful progress there. Thanks so much, Steve and Alan, for this wonderful episode talking about Carl Newport's book, Slow Productivity. Of course, you will find the link to the book and also to his other books in the show notes. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Alexander. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who helped with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.